In February 2025, Adriana Smith, who was pregnant, was declared brain dead. More than 90 days later, her mother claimed that representatives of Emory Hospital had told her that Georgia's abortion law made it illegal to withdraw Smith's ventilator. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Katie Watson, a professor of medical education, medical social sciences, and obstetrics and gynecology at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. Professor Watson has written a perspective article about brain injury or brain death in pregnancy and abortion law. Professor Watson, what do we know about the case of Adriana Smith?
Well, from news reports and her mother's interviews in the news, the latest update is that Ms. Smith's baby was delivered by cesarean section at approximately 25 weeks of gestation, and as far as we know, is still receiving care in the NICU. Ms. Smith's funeral happened recently, and she has been laid to rest.
What argument did the hospital make to support keeping Smith on a ventilator? And was it legally valid based on Georgia law and federal law?
I want to be delicate here because the hospital did not speak publicly very much about its position. And so what we have is Ms. Smith's mother's report of what she was told. And I'm a lawyer by training, and this is my inner lawyer wanting to be careful, as well as being a clinical ethicist, about not having a full comprehensive report. But Ms. Smith's mother said that someone from Emory told her that it was because Georgia's abortion law prohibits abortion provision after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and Ms. Smith was more than 6 weeks pregnant when she was declared brain dead. So that is the mother's version of events. The hospital issued a statement saying that it follows state law, state and federal law, and one of the statements apparently did mention the abortion statute. I don't have any inside knowledge of the case. I do know the Complex Family Planning Group. They understand the Georgia law very well and are strong advocates for their patients. The ethics team there is as well. So I think there's probably a complicated backstory there. That's a long way of saying the family's understanding was the decision wasn't up to them.
In your perspective article, you compare this case with that of Marlies Munoz in Texas. What happened in that case?
In the Marlies Munoz case, Ms. Munoz was 14 weeks pregnant, and at that time, she had a federal constitutional right to have an abortion much further than that. But the Texas hospital said that their state's law suspending advance directives for pregnant people meant that the family had to continue with the mechanical ventilation. And you can hear me hesitating there. I was about to say life support, which we reflexively say. And there's an interesting language detour there. When someone has been declared brain dead, the term life support really isn't quite correct. And you'll read authors using terms like corporeal support or somatic support, organ support. I think of it as body support to distinguish from someone who we've declared dead. But the hospital said the ventilation and all the other support must continue, even though the husband and the family were in agreement that she would not have wanted this. And so in that case, it was this advance directive statute that became relevant. And it's important to note that approximately 30 states have these statutes. I think of them as sort of sleeper statutes that it's not something we discuss very much when we talk about end-of-life care planning, that the state could say your advance directive doesn't apply. So that case was litigated. And I think that's an important contrast to the Smith case, where the family never filed a lawsuit and a court was never involved, where both sides would really air a position and a court would make a resolution or a ruling. But in the Munoz case, the hospital argued the Texas Advance Directives Act applied and required that care. The family argued it didn't, but the family also brought an argument under a Texas statute prohibiting abuse of a corpse, which was a really savvy lawyering move. As a lawyer, I think of these delicate decisions from the legal perspective as the difference between lawyering for the individual and the moment versus lawyering for like a group or a population in the long term. So that lawyer had an obligation to Ms. Munoz and her family and the who hired them, used very, very deftly got out of a debate about abortion or end-of-life law by using that abuse of a corpse statute. And that district judge ruled Ms. Munoz is dead. stop imposing medical treatments that her family refuses, and went with the abuse of a corpse statute. So that's an end run around that. Not every state has that type of statute, but that case was an important flag that even in states that offer abortion protections, those statutes exist and clinicians have to be ready to reckon with them.
Are there situations in which state and federal law might permit multiple courses of action in cases like this? And who should be responsible for making the ultimate decision?
That's a great question. My argument and my perspective piece is that pretty much in all cases, state and federal law leave the decision making to the patient and their family. And by the patient, of course, I mean the same thing that we always mean in end of life law, that we want to follow their wishes if they have made an advance declaration of what their wishes are. And when their families are deciding, we're asking their families to use substituted judgment to tell us if your loved one was fully conscious and could see the exact situation right now, what would they say? So my argument in the perspective piece is twofold. One is with regard to the abortion laws, that Georgia's abortion law did not govern the situation in Ms. Smith's case. And the important distinction here is between omission and commission, that abortion is an act of commission to interrupt ongoing pregnancy and interrupt nature's course, whereas removing end-of-life care is an act of omission and letting nature take its course, the underlying disease or issue that is leading to death. And the Supreme Court has very clearly distinguished acts of commission and acts of omission in three important cases about the end of life, in Cruzan, Vacco versus Quill, and the Glucksberg case. And that's something clinicians can really rely on, that ending life support is not an abortion. So part one of the answer is that even states with abortion bans, those bans do not prevent following the normal paths for end-of-life care. The second part of that answer is trickier with the advanced directive statutes. It is completely understandable that clinicians could read that one phrase in their advanced directive statute that says something like, a pregnant person's advanced directive under this statute shall be given no force and effect, and think, oh my gosh, the flip of that is I must continue life support or body support, if we're talking about someone who's brain dead, that this legislative statement means I have to continue this treatment. That is legally incorrect. What it means is that that advance directive will not govern the decision. But then you go to step two, which is the same step two that you do for anyone who has had a devastating neurological event or, you know, is in a persistent vegetative state or is brain dead, that you go to the step two decision-making. So let's stick with the PVS scenario. You go to surrogate decision-making and substituted judgment. The same way, even if you had an advance directive, but say it wasn't notarized and your state requires a notary, you wouldn't be bound by it, but you would consider it evidence of that person's wishes. And so in this perspective, I argue that under both state laws, the abortion law and the advance directive law and federal law, we're still in the realm of patient-driven or family using substituted judgment-driven decision-making for end-of-life care for pregnant people. And the preliminary question that's being posed in both the Smith case and the Munoz case is, who is the decision-maker, the state or the patient via their family? And I think that we have to stand firm on the legal and constitutional interpretation that it is still the patient. You would need a very different type of statute to rob an adult of their end-of-life decision-making authority. Very different type. And that's different than an abortion ban, and it's different than the mere suspension of the advance directive statute.
Finally, how can clinicians be prepared to handle potentially similar cases in their own states?
The goal of my perspective was to give them some legal guidance. Of course, they're going to want to consult their hospital counsel and others. My hope is that all the noise and controversy and fear that surrounds abortion law today or the contested rights of pregnant people, that clinicians can step away from that and go back to basics and just remember that this is an adult with a catastrophic injury and I know how to do this. In some cases, families will say, my gosh, she said she, in an advance directive she wrote 5 years ago, she wouldn't have wanted any kind of life or body sustaining measures, but she would have changed her mind if she understood, fill in the blank. 4 weeks on this care would help her deliver this healthy baby that she wanted so much and that our family is ready to raise. You can also imagine other families saying, oh, wow, if she knew she wasn't going to be here to parent this child, she would not want to continue this pregnancy. Whatever the facts of the situation are, she would have said absolutely not. That clinicians should follow whichever directions the family's representation of the patient's wishes go. And I think what's so interesting is we have these dramatic, in ethics, what we think of as neon light cases that you teach with and everyone remembers. We have no idea how many teams have simply consulted with families, and families have said she would not have wanted this, and they ended the treatment consistent with the family and patient's wishes, despite the fact the patient was pregnant. It may have changed the family's decision making, but it didn't change the clinical decision making. We have no idea how many cases are out there like that, and I'm going to just venture a guess that those are the vast majority. There are case reports outside of the two that I mentioned of sustaining pregnant women's bodies to continue pregnancies with the sole goal of helping to continue gestation. Many of those say because that's what the family wanted. And so I think these cases are more exceptions than I'm guessing. This is a hypothesis than the rule, but I'm worried they'll scare clinicians into thinking they must continue treatment in a state of suspended consciousness or brain death, and that's not the legal takeaway message they should receive. There's another area of law that I didn't cover in the piece because of word limitations, but I also would encourage clinicians to think about the law around organ donation and the idea that you cannot take an organ from someone after they've died against their will, regardless of the fact that it could lead to one or many more people going on to live. To force treatment for pregnant people would completely upend the legal structure and philosophy and ethical rules around organ donation. And so that's a whole other area of law that supports this analysis.
Thank you, Professor Watson.